Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. When Atlantis completed the 135th flight of the space shuttle program in 2011, it marked the beginning of a nearly nine-year period in which the United States has lacked the ability to launch its own astronauts into space, instead relying on the Russians to ferry Americans to the International Space Station. But that has changed with the first crewed flight of the SpaceX Dragon capsule launched by a Falcon 9 rocket booster from historic Launch Complex 39A at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. That's the same pad that launched American astronauts to the moon during the Apollo program, and later on in the show, we'll check in with a software engineer, Ben Feist, and Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter project scientist Noah Petro about how NASA is using LRO data combined with moonwalks from Apollo to train future lunar explorers in the Artemis program that NASA hopes will return the U.S. to the moon by 2024. Our first guest will be doing commentary for NASA TV during the SpaceX Dragon Demo 2 mission, which was set to lift off from Florida on May 27th. Unfortunately, a weather delay due to lightning scrubbed the launch. But as soon as weather and orbital mechanics permit, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley will hopefully be on their way to the International Space Station. Daniel Hewitt is a NASA spokesperson, and he joined us recently from Houston to talk about the historic return to space from American soil. Daniel Hewitt, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's great to be here. Thanks, David.
So this is called Crew Dragon Demo 2. Could you explain to us the title?
Yeah. So Crew Dragon is the spacecraft. This is a mission that NASA's flying with SpaceX. It's a company out of Hawthorne, California. A lot of people have probably heard of them by this point. We've had a lot of work with SpaceX over the years. They've flown cargo for us, and now they're going to be flying people for us. The mission itself is called Demo 2. It's short for Demonstration Mission 2. Prior to SpaceX becoming a kind of a certified crew carrier for us, they had two demonstration missions, one of which they flew last year in March of 2019. And that was basically they sent a Crew Dragon from Florida all the way to the space station and brought it all the way home, but there were no people on it. This is the second one, and really the only difference in this one is you have people on it for the first time. It's a pretty significant difference, and this is going to be the first time we've launched people from Florida and on an American spacecraft since we retired the shuttle in 2011. So really big deal, really big step, really big mission coming up.
Yeah, that, you know, having Americans on board is the key difference here, and launching from the Space Coast. It's been a long time, but this isn't the first time that we had a hiatus like this. You know, between the end of the Apollo Skylab program to the space shuttle, we also had a period of time where we weren't launching from Florida.
Yep, that was also a several year gap before the shuttle came online in 81, and honestly, it's been almost 9 years since the shuttle retired. This is longer than we expected it to take to get everything off the ground. But one thing we always say whenever people are asking why it's that spaceflight is hard, it's still one of the hardest things technically human beings try to do. And so it really does take time. And anytime you're talking about putting people on something like a rocket, you're not going to do it until you've eliminated every single safety risk you could possibly think of. You're never able to eliminate all of the risk. Again, it's spaceflight. It's hard. There's always an inherent risk when you're putting a human being on top of a controlled explosion. But we've done a lot of work to get to where we are now to be confident that they're going to be safe when they fly on this rocket. There's been a lot of tests, a lot of pretty dynamic tests that were pretty spectacular looking also. If anybody followed the ascent abort test that SpaceX did back in January, where they intentionally destroyed a Falcon 9 rocket on the way uphill just to demonstrate that the SpaceX capsule could use its abort system to fly off and get the crew away to safety. So there's been a lot of tests. There's been a lot of reviews. It's a lot of paperwork, unfortunately, which always takes time, but it's really all about the safety of the crew. We have a really important mission, but safety comes first.
Let's talk about that crew. You have some veteran astronauts, Robert Behnken, who's the Joint Operations Commander, and Douglas Hurley, the spacecraft commander. Could you tell us, just give us, you know, little capsule views, bios of each of them, and what their responsibilities are on this first test mission?
Yeah, absolutely. It's Bob and Doug, as we like to refer to them, Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. They've both been astronauts since the 2000s, the early 2000s. They've both flown on two shuttle missions. Bob Behnken flew on Endeavour twice, and then Doug Hurley flew his first one on STS-127, which was an Atlantis mission to bring up big pieces of the space station. And then Doug Hurley flew on the very last shuttle mission, that one in 2011. He was the pilot. He was one of four crew members to kind of close out the space shuttle program. And both of them since then have had a couple of different jobs in the astronaut office. When astronauts aren't specifically training for a mission, they essentially have like a normal NASA job, as normal as NASA jobs get, where they go support engineers or scientists or the medical field, whatever they kind of specialize in. They do that in between. And Bob Behnken was actually the chief of the astronaut office for a couple of years. The two of them got assigned to what we called the commercial crew cadre. It was four crew members. It was the two of them, Eric Bo and Sonny Williams, several years back, to work directly with SpaceX and Boeing on the commercial crew program. So we embedded astronauts as soon as possible into their process to be giving feedback as they were developing these spacecraft. When you're able to take the humans who are ultimately going to be flying the machine, it's great and it's invaluable insight to have them in that process flow when you're actually developing. So you don't build a spacecraft, stick an astronaut in it, and they go, what the heck is this thing? Well, it shouldn't be like that. You're able to get that feedback from them really early on. And then Bob and Doug were formally assigned to this mission back in 2018. So since then, they've been totally focused on this flight, and that's doing a lot of training. SpaceX has simulators with the Dragon spacecraft. By that point, they were still helping them finish building the things like the displays and the control systems and getting familiar with the life support and basically every in and out of that spacecraft. The astronauts have to know about it and they have to know how to fix it or what to do if it doesn't work. Or I mean, any number of things. Training for a spaceflight is incredibly hard. It's almost like going back to school a lot of times. It's a lot of classroom time. It's a lot of time in simulators. It's doing simulated missions. So we've been doing a lot of these, we call them sims, where you have all of the different players who would be there on game day. So your flight directors, your flight controllers, your medical doctors, the astronauts, and everybody does simulated mission. And there's actual data that's being fed. So you're able to react to different things breaking in the spacecraft or, you know, things going off nominal. It's a term we always use. Nominal just means normal. So every time you deviate from the plan. And they've been doing a whole bunch of those, wrapping up several over the last couple of months. And now we're really on the home stretch. Pretty soon they're going to go into quarantine, which a lot of people can probably relate to now with the given environment that we're all in. But that's something that's been standard for astronauts going to the space station for years. But they're going to do that. And then in just a couple of weeks, they'll climb into Dragon and head up to the space station.
Well, and let's talk about that really briefly, you know, the quarantine situation, because I imagine, you know, you're taking even extra precautions beyond the normal 14-day quarantine or right before launch. You know, what kinds of things have we been doing to make sure that these guys, and I'm assuming they're able to be with their families, that they're keeping them fairly isolated?
Correct. And the final stages of their training were over the last weeks and couple of months. And so we've had to adapt how their training was done in light of all of the COVID-19 stuff. And it's following all the best practices as they come out from the CDC. So you're limiting the amount of people that are in close contact with them. Anybody who does have to be in close contact, it's PPE, it's masks, it's gloves. It's just you have these two individuals who are pretty much the most important too. You can't have the mission without the astronauts. And so it's really just taking every step to minimize any chance as they're doing this final training to expose them to anything. They're still able to be with their families, and then they'll go into quarantine 14 days before the mission. So they'll go into a quarantine facility here in Houston, where the amount of people that have contact is extremely strict, and it's essentially only people who are also in that quarantine. They have a small support staff, another astronaut who's with them, who's able to, you know, kind of take care of them over these 2 weeks. And then when they're a week out from launch, so on May 20th, they'll fly down to the Kennedy Space Center. So they'll take either a NASA plane or in the past, they're both pilots, so they can fly the NASA T-38 jets. And they'll fly down to Florida, and then they'll go into quarantine at the astronaut crew quarters down in Florida, and they'll stay there until the day of launch. And that's where they'll get suited up. That's where they'll walk out. That'll be kind of there. That if you ever think back to a shuttle mission or anything, there's those doors that swing open, and then you see the crew walk down in the big orange suits. They're not going to be wearing orange suits this time, but it's those exact same doors that they're going to be walking through.
Yeah, very historic doors and a historic launch site, Launch Complex 39A that launched Americans to the moon back in the 1960s and early 70s.
Yeah, and it was used for, Apollo missions, space shuttle missions, and now it's going to be used for this. SpaceX has been leasing a pad from NASA for years now, and they gave it kind of a 21st century upgrade. Building out the new service structure, the new crew access arm. It's pretty sleek if you haven't seen it yet. So everything, a lot of the stuff there is brand new. So you're getting that kind of nice juxtaposition between, you know, this has been the site of some of the greatest things humanity has ever achieved, and here it is launching a whole new era now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the mission, and let's start with the spacecraft. Give us a sense of, you know, the size of the, you know, because a lot of people don't know. This is not the space shuttle. This is not a large spacecraft. So give us a sense of how big it is in terms of, you know, how much room the astronauts have in there and what kind of crew capacity it has.
Yeah, it's definitely a little cramped quarters, but that's kind of everything with spaceflight. You're constantly in this battle of getting just the right kind of fit. It's kind of the three little bears, not too big, not too small, just right in the middle. Because anytime a spacecraft is bigger, that's more weight. Anytime there's more weight, that means you need more fuel. Anytime you need more fuel, it gets more expensive and it just gets more difficult. And so they went with a capsule design. So it may look almost like you're going back in time a little bit compared to the space shuttle, but the reason we've had a capsule design throughout Gemini, Apollo, Mercury, the reason the Russians use a capsule design for their spacecraft, the reason Boeing's was also a capsule design is that's really the most efficient way to get a crew up and most importantly to bring a crew back. When you're talking about re-entering the Earth's atmosphere and the shape of your heat shield and everything, the capsule makes sense. The physics makes sense to use that kind of design, and physics hasn't changed since the 60s. So that's why you're seeing a return to that capsule design. We know that it can do the thing that it's being built for, and these are only being built to take crew up. So with shuttle, you were delivering large pieces of the International Space Station. You were delivering Hubble. You were fixing satellites. You were doing all of these things where you needed kind of that pickup truck vehicle that the shuttle was. In terms of this, we just need a crew transport system. So that's why you see the capsule. The capsule itself is attached to the trunk. I know once the capsule's on top of the trunk, it's about 27 feet tall. It'll look pretty big if you stand next to it. It's definitely larger. Just the capsule itself is larger than an SUV. The internal space isn't super spacious, but SpaceX originally designed it to hold up to 7 people. Now, you're not putting 7 people in there for days or weeks. It would just be several hours or at most about a day or so. For our missions, they're going to carry 4 people. So once we put SpaceX into the rotation of regularly carrying crews up and down from the space station, you'll have 4 people on board. And there are seats for all 4 people. We can also bring cargo up. And inside the spacecraft, there's kind of all of the different things you need. Just for kind of like a long road trip almost. They have food that they bring up with them. They have water. They have a bathroom on board if they need it. And on this actual flight, they're going to be sleeping inside the capsule. They're going to launch. And then it'll be about 19 hours until they get to the space station. So they'll launch, do some stuff right on orbit, and then they're actually going to go to sleep for 8 hours, wake up, and then finish their trip to the station. So it's got enough size inside for what it needs to do. And that's really just get the crew up and down from the space station. They can stay on board for a couple of days if necessary. They have enough breathing oxygen and water and food and things like that. And that's really just to protect for kind of when you go off nominal. You're not going to plan to put them in there for days on end. But if they have an issue on the way up to space station, if you're about to land and all of a sudden the weather takes a turn for the worse and you need to wait a day, they have that capability.
You know, this is a test flight, and of course, they're test pilots. Let's talk a little bit about the control system. This is new. There's been a lot of talk about the touchscreen system. And could you describe that for us a little bit instead of the old stick and rudder that you'd find, for example, on this space shuttle?
Yeah, it's definitely a departure from what even test pilots have been used to. And Bob and Doug actually talked about this a little bit the other week. Dragon is designed to be fully autonomous. And so if everything works as intended, the spacecraft essentially flies itself from planet Earth all the way to the space station. Everything is controlled and executed by the flight computer. And then if for some reason, like let's say you lose a sensor and you need to take manual control and guide it in just visually, then you would be able to have Bob and Doug take over, and they would use a touch screen, and we'll be able to show people kind of right over their shoulder what that's going to look like. They're going to do a maneuvering test shortly after they get on orbit, just a couple of hours afterwards. And we'll have a camera kind of right behind them looking at the screens, and you'll be able to see. And it almost looks like a video game. There are just different arrows that pop up on the screen, and they're able to just maneuver the vehicle so they can actually send commands to fire the thrusters on the outside of Dragon to change their attitude, or they're even right when they're about to get to the space station, they're going to do what we call translational control. So they'll actually send commands to move Dragon left, right, up, down, and not just where it's pointing. So it is a test flight. And while those systems have been tested on the ground and simulated, this will be your chance to really kind of put them through the paces. We did a bunch of tests on the first demo mission where we tested things you didn't need the crew in the loop for. So a couple of different rendezvous docking things, executing an abort. So just sending a command to the spacecraft, hey, back away. And then it gets away from the space station, things like that. And with this test flight, we'll have crew on board. So we're going to test out the things that you need a crew for. And that's those manual controls on the touchscreen.
Yeah, and of course, the other great thing about this being a first flight is they'll be able to relay to future astronauts, you know, what the ride is like, what you can expect, you know, because that's always important information to pass along. We're almost out of time, but before we let you go, give us the timeline here. What time is launch on the 27th?
Yeah, launch time actually just changed. We went from 4:32 Eastern to 4:33 Eastern, so it changed by a minute. And it might tweak a little bit more as we get a little bit closer. They're just constantly refining when that exact launch time is based off where the station is. And so they'll just continue to refine that. But right now, liftoff is targeted for 4:33 p.m. Eastern time on May 27th. And if they're able to launch at 4:33 p.m. Eastern time, they'll arrive at the station the next day at 11:39 a.m. Eastern. So they'll launch on the 27th and they'll get there on the 28th. And then once they get there, we're kind of launching them with a question mark. We don't know exactly how long they're going to stay. They've been trained as expedition crew members. So they got some additional training to do spacewalks and support science experiments and things like that. And then they'll be up there for anywhere from 1 month to 3 months. It depends on how quickly we can get things turned around down here to get ready to launch the next crew, which we're hoping to do a month after Bob and Doug return home. So it's going to be pretty quick. So we're going to go from not having launched humans from Florida in about 9 years to launching two crews from Florida just this year. So it's going to be exciting.
Very exciting. And everybody can follow that on NASA TV, or I imagine the networks are going to be doing a lot of coverage on this too, the cable news networks, because this is going to be historic. And I just, you know, as we say in the old days, Godspeed. And thanks for sharing your expertise with us. Daniel Hewitt, spokesman for NASA, I really appreciate you getting us up to speed on this mission, and we'll be watching it closely as America returns to space from American soil.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, and I really do hope everyone tunes in. You'll see and hear me on TV doing all the commentary for the mission, so definitely tune in. We want everyone to watch this. It's going to be a really big achievement, and I think people need something kind of cool to get excited about right now, and hopefully this is that thing.
Thanks to Dan Hewitt, NASA spokesperson. He joined us from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. You can follow the SpaceX Dragon 2 mission on NASA.gov or NASA TV. Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll hear how NASA is using data from the Apollo moonwalks and the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter to prepare a new generation of moon explorers for the Return to the Moon program called Artemis. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Our next guests are Ben Feist and Noah Petro. I first learned about Ben when our good friend Jerry Griffin, one of Apollo's original flight directors, told me about Feist's Apollo in Real Time website, where you can relive missions like Apollo 11, 13, and 17 as they happened, listening to the astronauts and flight controllers, along with the iconic voices of Apollo, NASA spokesmen like Paul Haney and Douglas Ward. It was an amazing, immersive experience listening to Apollo 13 in real time recently, and I called Ben Feist to ask him about it. When he told me what he was working on now with Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter project scientist Noah Petro, I became very interested and decided to invite them both onto the program to tell us about what they're working on for NASA's Artemis program, which plans to return American astronauts to the moon by 2024. Both of them joined us remotely recently to talk about their work. Ben Feist and Noah Petro, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, so Ben, I'd like to start out with you. How I became aware of you was through your wonderful audio visual series that you do recreating the Apollo missions. We recently had the 50th anniversary of Apollo 13, and I was able to experience that in real time as if I was back in April of 1970, and it was just a wonderful experience. And I'd like you to tell us how you got started doing that, because I believe it was with Apollo 17. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I had a job in the advertising and marketing industry as a software engineer. And when I got home from work, I would work on these Apollo programs. And I started with Apollo 17, just seeing if I could come up with a way to try to reanimate the mission and make it come back to life.
And I'd like to know a little bit more, like, tell us how long it took, for example, to go through Apollo 17, because a lot of that information was missing, wasn't it?
Yes, it took a very long time. It took me 6 years of effort from starting in about 2009 to clean all the transcripts, and this transcript is 2,400 pages long, and to basically take all the historical audio that was recorded of the space-to-ground transmissions and tie it all together with photographs that were taken and footage that was shot. And I essentially made a 300 hour long Adobe Premiere project that had all of this material in it.
And Noah, I'd like to know how you got involved with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And, you know, for our listeners who may not be aware, why don't you give us a little thumbnail biography of LRO?
Sure. So LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, is NASA's mission that's been at the moon for now over 10 years, which for a mission that was supposed to last 2 years is pretty remarkable. It was sent to the moon to basically act as the forerunner to future human and robotic exploration of the lunar surface. And so the mission has seven instruments on it, all of which are supposed to characterize the lunar surface and environment in a way that would enable future exploration. Where to go safely, where there might be resources to use for future exploration, volatiles, water, ice, and the like. And so all of the instruments contribute to that understanding of the surface and environment. And it was initially, again, just supposed to be this very focused two-year mission. But here we are now, 10 plus years later, still enjoying the fruits of its scientific labor. I got involved with the mission basically as soon as I went to Goddard in 2007 as a postdoc. I went to Goddard because they wanted lunar scientists there. And in my era, coming out of grad school, there was not a lot of lunar scientists, early career lunar scientists. So I really was at this sort of early stage of reinvigoration of a lunar community, and got to Goddard and started working with the mission, helping communicate the science goals of the mission to the world. Got hired to stay on Goddard permanently, and have worked my way up the ranks to now being the project scientist, basically the chief scientist responsible for keeping the mission productive. And so it's a great responsibility, and it's a great joy to work with the seven instrument teams, the scientists, the engineers who keep the mission running, and most importantly, getting the data out for the entire world to enjoy.
And the mapping of the moon done by LRO over the last decade is just, it's amazing. But one of my favorite things is that you guys have imaged the Apollo landing sites. Could you tell us just briefly about that?
Sure. You know, we have on LRO, we have a camera system called LROC, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera. And part of that is this thing called the NAC, the Narrow Angle Camera, which is actually two cameras that is capable of imaging the surface at centimeter per pixel scale, 50 centimeter per pixel scale when we were orbiting the moon at 50 kilometers. And what that means is that when we image the Apollo landing sites, you can see the hardware. You can see the boot prints on the surface left behind by the Apollo astronauts. And so for me, that was one of the first and most interesting things that came out of it, was actually seeing these places that as a kid or as a you know, early career professional, kind of studied everything about Apollo. And so to see these places as they've been preserved now for over 50 years in their essentially pristine state was really remarkable for me. My father worked on Apollo. He was an engineer that built parts for the Apollo program. And so to see essentially the fruits of his labor still sitting on the surface today, 50 years after they were used, was really gratifying, not only demonstrating the capability of this incredible spacecraft, but also, you know, these incredible sites that sit there on the surface almost exactly as they were when the crews left 50 years ago. And so for me, that was the most emotional part of the mission, was seeing these places that we have explored, that I, as a fan of Apollo, had kind of pored over, seeing the hardware that my dad built sitting on the surface today was really amazing, and kind of emotionally drove this connection between the moon, my father's work, and this thing that I'm working on today. And it still tickles me every time I look at a picture of an Apollo site and can see the portable life support system, the backpacks tossed out from the limb, sitting on the surface, and think, oh, my dad had a little hand in building those things, and I have a little hand in making the spacecraft that's imaging them work. And so that's profound to me, and profound to see the fruits of so many people's labor preserved on the surface now 50 years later.
Oh, that's awesome. And do you remember the first time you saw one of those sites? Can you just briefly tell us about that? Which one was it?
Sure. So very early on, LRO got to the moon mid-June in 2009. And so that was in the build-up stages for the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. And so I think one of the, certainly the very first Apollo sites that I saw a picture of was the Apollo 11 site. These were images that were taken by our camera from a higher orbit. And so they were lower resolution than we become used to. But, you know, even in those first images, we could see the descent stage and the shadow of the descent stage and the hint of the traces of the boot prints in the from Apollo 11. We could see the two experiments that were set up. And so even in that first image where you could just begin to make out, oh, my God, there it is, was incredibly profound. Now, about a year and a half after that, we actually lowered the orbit to be able to image the Apollo sites at higher resolution, about 25 centimeters per pixel. And in those images, the detail you could make out, the boot prints and the hardware left behind at each of the sites was incredibly profound. I began to gravitate towards the Apollo 17 landing site because you could see the, you know, the amount of territory they covered was so much greater, and the stuff they left behind, the Apollo experiments, the rover, and you could start seeing, goodness, the wheels of the rover and the boot prints and the rover tracks. And so it became this, you know, kid in a candy store of, oh my goodness, there's the rover, there's the shadow of the flag, and oh my gosh, the first image I saw was Apollo 11, but I think it was the images of Apollo 17 that really drove home, oh my God, look what we can do. And look what they did.
Yeah. Well, back to you, Ben. So tell us how you became involved with NOAA and how you're using your expertise along with his. Now, how did you guys get hooked up?
I had put Apollo in real time, or the Apollo 17 version of that. It was at a domain called apollo17.org online in 2015. And then one day I got an email from someone at NASA that said, hey, cool website. And it was Noah Petro. And he was the first person within NASA to reach out and say hi. And of course, the first thing he pointed out was a mistake that I had made. So that was a good introduction to what my career at NASA was going to be like, unbeknownst to me many years later. But it was basically, hey, this is a really cool thing that you've made here. And Noah and I struck up a friendship, and we just started chatting with each other on the phone until eventually one day I called him and said, hey, listen, you work on that LRO mission, right? Don't you, maybe you have some imagery or data or something of the Apollo 17 landing site. And when I asked Noah that, I honestly didn't know any of the stuff he just explained to you. And Noah leapt at it and said, oh my goodness, I have all this data. We have all this detailed stuff. And he coordinated with another gentleman at Goddard to make sure that I had everything that I needed to try to make 3D renderings of the LRV traverses that they made on Apollo 17. So my thought was I could use LRO data to essentially recreate where they drove when they were driving on the surface by animating it in 3D and using a 3D program. So I did that in the summer of 2015 and phoned Noah up when I was finished. And I said, hey, Noah, I did something with all that data that you sent me a few months ago. And the result was all there on apollo17.org.
Well, and all that is, you know, quite fascinating for me as a student of Project Apollo and a fan. But it also leads to what's going on now and into the future, because NASA is, you know, really wants to return to the moon. And I'm wondering if you guys, either one that wants to start, could tell us how you're using both of your talents and the LRO data. How are you using that to help inform the future exploration of the moon with Project Artemis?
Well, let me... Yeah. I mean, first of all, one of the things that Ben's Apollo 17 site does so well is puts that mission into its context of what they actually did. You can go to the site and you can see how EVA-2 worked. You can hear the astronauts talking to one another, mission control, and it exists in its entirety and not in 20-second snippets or in, you know, pages upon pages of text. And so what that's really useful in planning for the future is to see sort of how it worked. You have people who are there who can tell you what it was like, but this puts you in mission control and lets you sit and listen to the crew do their thing and talk to the Capcom and talk about how it's going to work and see it unfold. And what's really powerful about that is it lets you understand what worked and what maybe didn't work when they were on the surface. You flash forward to today and preparing for Artemis, and you say, well, you take the LRO data, you say, well, where do we want to go? We want to go to the South Pole. Here's the data. And you can look at the surface and start putting together traverses, safe landing site. Where do you want to go? What are the scientific high points? How do you plan the mission? But you can use Ben's tool, this great in real time tool, to understand how it worked then. You know what might be different going forward, but you know the same thing is you've got astronauts and well-trained astronauts on the surface implementing a plan. And so it's the great connection of the data that we have to plan where they're going to go, an understanding of how it actually worked on Apollo, and sort of ingesting the two together to try to put a best foot forward for planning for, you know, humans on the ground in Artemis. And so the data that we have from LRO, coupled with the sort of hindsight of how Apollo actually worked, is something very powerful, and I think will help us be even more prepared for Artemis 3 than we would have been, certainly, you know, without the in real time experience.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with NASA's Ben Feist and Noah Petro as we talk about how the past can inform the future in exploring the moon. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. Let's get back now to our conversation with NASA software engineer Ben Feist and Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter project scientist Noah Petro as we talk about how to use the data from the Apollo program and LRO to train future moon explorers. So Ben, can you maybe explain to us, you know, looking into the near future, how you guys would use this data set you have and your talents to, you know, to help train not just astronauts, but, you know, flight controllers and people like that?
Well, what I'm actually doing now, I work at Johnson Space Center. So Noah's at Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and I'm at Johnson Space Center in Houston. I'm building a system that will allow for spacewalks on the International Space Station to be replayed in a similar way that Apollo 17 is replayed on Apollo 17.org. And the insight here is that most of the organizations within NASA work within themselves vertically or integrated, you can think of it, where, you know, they work on an instrument like Noah mentioned, the LROC instrument on the LRO. That instrument team focuses on the camera and you know, they are very good at doing that. But there isn't a lot of lateral collaboration across to the other instruments or other things that are happening on a mission. And during a spacewalk on the space station, this is kind of at its extreme, is there's a lot of things that have to go right, not just the activities of the spacewalk, but all the environmental systems, all of the other timed and coordinated things, including all the engineers' work that had gone into building whatever the piece of material is that they're working with on the spacewalk. And that is a horizontal integration need. Really, what I've created is a way to tie together everything that isn't designed to be tied together just by using time. So if you are at a certain moment in the mission, you can pause and sort of move laterally into those other data sets and have a look at what was going on at that moment. And this provides you with an opportunity to organize things later on so that if you're on Artemis 3 and you're doing a spacewalk and you're walking on the surface of the moon and you collect a sample, that is all being gathered now. The data is being gathered in such a way that it doesn't take somebody like me 6 years to reconstruct what it is that was happening on the EVA, that I can contribute what that process was like to try to make sure the systems are in place. So for that data to be gathered in a way that allow it to be very quickly played back, perhaps minutes or hours after that spacewalk occurred. And then for years on after that, as you're, you know, if you want to learn something about this sample that was gathered that will be studied for the next 100 years, it will always have this other context data attached to that sample that's easily referenced and accessible to the people doing that research.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because I know there's still samples from Project Apollo that are, you know, kind of sitting in pristine condition awaiting for us to use our latest technology to examine them. And I know some are from Apollo 17, for example. And I know, Noah, the, you know, lunar geology is one of your passions, mm-hmm. as is mine. And I'm, you know, thinking back to Apollo 17 was the only mission where we had a real geologist on the moon, the great Harrison Schmitt, who's a lunar module pilot. I'm just wondering, you know, mm-hmm. if either one of you have ever gotten to know Jack Schmitt?
So I've developed a great relationship with Jack, and Ben and I work with Jack fairly regularly. I mean, Ben just communicated with Jack the other day. I've co-authored paper with him and work with him on, you know, he's reinvigorated in studying his site using LRO data and using Ben's tool to jog his memory of all of those things. He's in the process of writing a book about his experience, a very detailed deep dive into his time going to the moon. And so what's been wonderful is that this LRO data recaptures his imagination for what it was like to be there and his interpretations of it. But it also shows us the power of our data for places we haven't been yet as well. And so what's been great is that Jack's perspective on where he went, how it went, and particularly, you know, the words that he used when he was on the surface. Jack talked so much on that mission, describing things as they're driving from station to station. And the great thing with Ben's site, as he alluded to, is that you can hear Jack talking about the drive from the lunar module to station two. And then what Ben has done is basically taking LRO data, allows you to fly along above them, follow them as they drive from station to station, and see what Jack saw, essentially. And so that becomes a really powerful tool, not just for communicating to lunar scientists of what was going on, but to future astronauts who were going to be doing the same type of thing, what it was like. And you know, Jack's narrated tour of, oh, I noticed that the raindrop pattern here on the light mantle is a little bit different than it was before. And that triggers in my mind when I hear something like that, okay, I've got to go look at this data set. And so it's the combination of having that field geologist on the surface narrating a tour. Ben's site allows you to finally put those observations into context thanks to LRO's data. And it's a happy marriage of the work that the crew did, the work that the people on LRO have done, and the work that Ben did to bring that mission to new life.
Yeah, and listening to Ben's Apollo 17 in real time, it's really fun to listen to Commander Gene Cernan, who's just a wonderfully enthusiastic lunar explorer in his own right. And the two of them together exploring that site at Taurus Littro in the mountains there is just, it's really an amazing experience. And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned that, because as great as a memory as you could have, something that happened 50 years ago, I know enough about human memory that it's very difficult to reconstruct it. But with all of this data you have for somebody like Jack Schmitt, it must be just wonderful to actually rekindle that memory.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
And what it does is the data and certainly Ben's site triggers thoughts of, oh yeah, well, I said this thing. Let me look at an image, a picture I took or Jack took. Okay, there's this. Let me see what the LRO data shows of this perspective, and it brings a new flood of interpretations that Jack is able to afford, and that we're all able to then carry on with.
Well, before we close this out, I'd like to get your thoughts on how optimistic you are in these very troubled times that we are going to be able to return to the moon by 2024, because, you know, this virus has thrown a monkey wrench in all kinds of things, and I'm sure spaceflight included, although I am very excited to see that we're going to have the first launch of American astronauts from American soil from historic pad 39A at Kennedy Space Center later this month, hopefully. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are moving forward with Project Artemis and the return to space for America.
Well,
Noah, do you want to take that? I will.
But before I go on, Ben, you had something I stepped over talking about Jack and revisiting Apollo 17.
Well, quickly, I wanted to mention that you hit on something really important when you mentioned that, is that human memory fades, and you know the stories at the bar get better and better from the people who were there as time goes on. And this is a way of pulling that veil of history away. So it's no longer a book being told from somebody who was there remembering what it was like in the great good old days. It is, what were the people like who were working in mission control and doing this job? And what you find out is that these people were just regular people. They were not heroes that, you know, wore capes all day. There are individuals in mission control who were complaining about overtime during Apollo 13, for example. You know, that's not the right stuff if you were to measure it, but maybe it is. Maybe that is part of what it takes for a team to do something. And that kind of cold reality of what happened on Apollo is a very important thing for us to be studying as we prepare for Artemis. Because otherwise, everybody preparing for Artemis might have the impression that we don't have the right stuff today, because it doesn't match any of the stories we've been hearing in the bar from people who were there 50 years ago.
The power of that website is also as a teaching tool of the next generation of astronauts that people are going to go to show. This is what Jack did on Station 8 on Apollo 17. This is the best example of field geology on the moon. Pay attention to this, this, and this. And it doesn't become some ethereal, oh, well, you have to, like, this is it. He describes what he's seeing. And that's really powerful to reinforce those lessons, both video, audio, and textually that Ben has enabled.
Well, before I let you go, just briefly, I'd like to get your last thoughts on what's your favorite part of working on this together? Let's ask you first, Ben.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, this has turned into a second career for me, and I get to work at NASA now, which is just unbelievable every day. It's so much fun. And I honestly, I don't understand how this has happened, but Noah was a big part of that, of encouraging me and looking for opportunities for me to do more stuff. So it's been absolutely wonderful working with Noah, and we're actually in the midst of putting a proposal together right now where we're going to formally work with each other on even more work. So I'm happy to be part of it.
And so for me, what really is important and is, you know, as a geologist, the context of the samples that were collected on Apollo are so important, and that's been somewhat lost over time. I'm, you know, used to going to conferences. People talk about Apollo 17 sample 74002 without any real context of when it was collected and where it's from. It's just this thing that exists. And what BenSight does, it takes the moment that sample was collected and puts it into the context of its location at the field site, how it was collected. And that's so important. And so what Ben's tools have done is bring these samples into the 21st century and lets you drill down to the second it was collected, what was the observation being made when it was collected. And that can inform our understanding of these samples. And so you mentioned earlier about, you know, the opportunity to study old samples with new techniques, samples that have never been studied before. And it's a perfect marriage between understanding these samples that have never been studied before and going back to the moment it was collected. And what was Jack and what was Gene saying when it was collected? Because that offers us clues to the context where these things come from, and that's invaluable. And so what I love about working with Ben is that he is as excited about Apollo, but the future as possible, as I am, and as many of us at NASA are. And, you know, I think it's the really great opportunity to bring the samples that have been collected and will be collected into people's homes and into the 21st century.
So, you know, in the current environment we have with, you know, everybody working remotely and, you know, budgets very uncertain, could you just tell us your thoughts on Project Artemis as we move forward, you know, and still having that goal of getting back to the moon by 2024, at least perhaps with an orbital mission?
Sure. You know, I'm very optimistic about our ability not just to get to lunar orbit, but to the surface by 2024. Even though we're all working remotely, work continues. You know, we can still plan landing sites and start identifying where we might want to go. We just announced the three candidates for building the landing system, the human-rated landing system. For the first time in 60 years, we've got a lander system. So work continues. Even though we're remote, we're still full speed ahead. And I am very optimistic that we will be celebrating a return to humans, the next man and first woman to the lunar surface in 2024.
Well, Ben Feist, NASA software engineer, and Noah Petro, project scientist for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about your partnership and all this really fascinating work and where it could lead us in the near future. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again to our guests, NASA software engineer Ben Feist, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter project scientist Noah Petro, and NASA spokesperson Daniel Hewitt. Check out Ben's website at apolloinrealtime.org and follow the SpaceX Dragon Demo 2 mission at nasa.gov. On a final note, I watched as all of us across the country did on Wednesday, hoping to see the SpaceX Dragon Demo 2 mission lift off from Pad 39A at Kennedy Space Center. My good friend TV meteorologist Rob Elvington, now at WAAY-TV in Huntsville, Alabama, sent me the latest high-resolution weather models that morning, and I could see it didn't look promising for launch. Sure enough, 20 minutes before the scheduled liftoff, SpaceX and NASA scrubbed the mission, hoping to fly a few days later. It reminded me of two events, when Apollo 12 was hit by lightning in November of 1969, which was scary but turned out okay. But then there was one that didn't. On January 28, 1986, I awoke to watch the Space Shuttle Challenger lift off. I was startled to see freezing temperatures and icicles forming on the stack. There was a teacher on board that spacecraft, Krista McAuliffe. NASA and the Reagan administration and school kids around the country were excited to see her get up into orbit and do lessons from space. In one of NASA's darkest moments, the Challenger 7, Dick Scobee, Mike Smith, Ron McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Judy Resnick, Greg Jarvis, and of course Krista were all killed when the O-rings on the solid rocket boosters failed due to those freezing temperatures and destroyed Challenger 73 seconds into flight. Spaceflight is dangerous. The most dangerous parts are liftoff and reentry. And so when lightning was detected near Pad 39A and SpaceX and NASA called the abort, I felt relieved. One of Ronald Reagan's greatest speeches was his eulogy for the Challenger 7. I don't ever want to hear another one like it. Scrubbing launches due to iffy weather is a very good thing. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We are distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of Dog Nang Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.